Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we have Mr. John Karloftis and a little trip to the Louisville Zoo. Haven't been there for a while. We're going to find out about turtles because today is World Turtle Day.
Isn't that exciting?
It is.
I had no idea there was a World Turtle Day.
I have a crazier story to tell you in just a moment, but we'll get through this first.
The World Turtle Day came to the Wishy Estate.
There was some sort of serendipitous occurrence,
yes.
Did you
have a turtle race out there?
I just wait.
Okay. Little saddles and little...
John Karloftis is a garden designer, an author, a lecturer, and Harold's from Kentucky. He sort of made his name for himself in New York City, but frequently comes back home to do design work and other things. And he's written a new book called The Beautiful Gardens of Kentucky. And he's also going to be later today, and in fact, Bob and I are going to MC the event.
Yeah,
he's going to be later today doing a benefit lecture and book signing. Proceeds are going to Botanica and Brightside. But he's going to be at 2 o'clock down at the Henry Clay. And we wanted to be able to talk to him about his book because it really is something a little bit different. You know, you would think that he's this perfectionist, and I'm sure he is in many ways. But he's so much more like naturally bound to the landscape than a lot of people.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy you like instantly because you can't separate him from his work.
Yeah.
I love people like that.
And from his roots, too.
Yeah.
You know, and, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, and it's played a part in his development and probably, frankly, in some of the jobs he gets because he's able to kind of work both sides of the world, but it never changes him at all.
Yeah, it doesn't. So Beautiful Gardens of Kentucky highlight 21 different gardens from small urban, suburban gardens to estate gardens to sort of farms as well. In all of their perfection, meaning their imperfection, you know, all of their natural perfection, you know, he doesn't try to hide any of the natural beauty of these
places. The photographer didn't for sure, which made the book more attractive to me.
Yeah.
Then it's off to the Louisville Zoo for World Turtle Day. I'm excited about this.
I am too.
Bill McMahon, we've had him on before. He's been there for 29 years. Just an amazing guy. He's curator of ecotherms, and I have to ask him again what the heck that is because I don't have a clue what an ecotherm is, but he curates them.
Yeah.
And we're going to go out there. We're going to get deeply into ecotherms and tortoises and turtles and terrapins and what's the difference. And
I think ectotherm is
don't tell me I want to find out from Bill. We'll keep the listeners at bay until then.
Okay. I think I learned it from him the last time we were there.
All right, well, but see, this is know-it-all. Bill will tell us later on.
And it's Latin, too.
I know. I see you're itching to spill the beans of what an ectotherm is. We're going to hold you off.
All right. So we'll wait on that. That's coming up in part two of the show. We hope that you'll stick around.
Yeah.
Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Actually, we had this really early blooming season. Everything bloomed at once. Then the colors kind of fade away. And I like to go out in the garden then and watch the greens kick in. You know, all the dogwoods and the red buds and the viburnums, everything was blooming at once. And then they're gone. But when I give tours out there, you know, the colors, they fade, but there's a million kinds of greens in the garden, the textures, I have the weeping green beets, the skyadopitus, the weeping junipers, the parotias, the birch trees, the paper bark maple. Each one is a different kind of green, and I make people look at those greens and enjoy that as much as the color, because that's part of the garden.
Yeah.
And we shut our eyes and listen to the birds at the same time.
Well,
it's really cool.
Instead of taking in the whole, it's noticing the little details.
The details. Yeah. And the flow of greens is just astounding. Mm-hmm. And I always talk about that because I am amazed by it, and it's just part of the joy of the transition to the next phase of color, which is coming.
Yeah.
How about the Wishy Estate? What's up?
Well, this is this crazy serendipitous story.
A turtle story.
And I'm not making this up.
I know you. Don't tell lies.
This morning, I had to make a phone call, so I went to pick up the phone. And I look out the kitchen window, right?
Yep.
You know, which is the south side.
I've been there.
And there's that point at which I stop mowing, you know, as we move into where the nut grove is.
10 feet from the house?
Not quite 10 feet, but, you know, it actually gets closer and closer every year. So, you know, looking out towards the nut grove and then right along that edge where I mow and then don't mow,
right.
I see this thing going through the grass.
Uh-oh.
What is today?
Turtle Day.
World Turtle Day.
You see a turtle?
I swear. There's this, as I'm getting ready to go talk about World Turtle Day, I look out my window and there's this turtle walking through the grass. Is that not like tell you something somehow, somewhere?
It's supposed to happen.
How big was this turtle? I went down to look at it, actually. And it was probably, how big is that?
Wow.
It was
probably basketball size.
Yeah.
Half a basketball.
Yeah, enough to see from that far away, right?
Man, where was it headed?
And it was headed towards, away from the lake, towards Connor Station.
Oh, okay.
You know, so it was heading west.
be there by 2012.
Yeah. But it was probably a snapper. I'm not really sure. We'll ask Bill later. I did take note of its markings, but it I just thought it was kind of, okay,
perfect.
Yes, this is meant to be, and this will have to be a good day if there's a turtle walking through my grass on World Turtle Day.
I meant to mention this earlier, too. I did a column, one of my favorites, about a runaway turtle.
Yeah.
Runaway. It was a posting in a laundromat or somewhere I was at. It wouldn't be a laundromat. Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
But something about runaway turtle. If you see it, call. And I went to the house, and their turtle, if it's possible, ran away, and they found it a quarter of a block.
You got some time to get on that one.
About
right?
A week later, somebody found their turtle about a quarter block from the house.
Aww.
And I went out and talked to him and interviewed the turtle. So it was just fun.
And then there's the guy that walks the turtle from Wayside Christian Mission downtown, which is pretty cool, too. So clearly there's something going on with turtles.
Yeah,
smarter than you think.
But there's other things going on around here, too.
There are indeed. As we mentioned, later today at 2 p.m., John Karloftis, his lecture at the Henry Clay, which will benefit Brightside and Botanica, and you're welcome at the door there. Also, May 29th, Memorial Day weekend, right? It's the famed Strawberry Festival in Starlight, Indiana, so you might want to check that out if you're a strawberry lover.
And one of my favorite towns, you like Indiana, and I've always liked Bardstown. They're having the 7th annual Blooming Bardstown Garden Tour, Saturday, June 5th, rain or shine, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. They've got 8 private gardens, plus there's going to be a master gardener's marketplace, open from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's free to the public, so great tour of Bardstown. See our website for more information on time and tickets and so forth.
All right. Sounds good. On to Mr. John Karloftis. It's always a pleasure to talk with him. He's joining us. He is a professional gardener, designer, and writer originally from Rockcastle County, Kentucky. But John made his name for himself among the terrace gardens in New York City. Today, he gardens and lectures here and there, but it does seem that he's in Kentucky a little bit more, and we're glad to have him home and to have him joining us on Homegrown today. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Rockcastle County is where you are from. How is Rockcastle and growing up there reflected in your choice to become a professional gardener?
Well, I didn't know that I could be one. We grew up, my parents were, I guess, kind of hippies before they were hippies. My father inherited this beautiful home, which is still there in Pineville, Kentucky. And when he got married to Mama in 1949, they decided they just wanted to go out, find a place in the country somewhere, and start a business. They wanted to do summer theater and have an American Indian, a Native American museum. So they found this piece of property surrounded by the Daniel Boone National Forest in 1955, and the first 6 weeks they had a Model T engine for a generator to build the house and build everything. We didn't have a TV till 1990-something, 98.
Wow.
Not a telephone till 1969, and we didn't have city water until the 90s either.
Uh-huh.
So I just grew up, if you don't have TV, what are you going to do? My oldest brother grew birds.
That's right.
He had parrots and we still have peacocks at home. Still, we've always had 20 or 30 peacocks around. And my other brother liked to hunt and fish, and I liked to garden. So
yeah, perfect. So you went to University of Kentucky, graduated there, and then you went on to New York City. And, I think that's, if I may say, and I may be wrong about this, but it does seem like you're back home a little bit more often.
Yes.
The
last few years, I've just been getting some really great projects in Louisville, actually, is what kind of started it, doing rooftops and with the Fishers and the Rectors and Laurie Brown, and I've enjoyed that, and then picked doing jobs here, and I'll be back in New York. I leave a week from today. I go back up there for a week to see the nice people and get all my clients. But I know when I sit in that traffic, And I think, oh my gosh, I wish I was out in a field somewhere. I'm old. You know, I'm getting old. So I'm doing what I want to do now.
Good.
And, and that involves coming home to Kentucky.
More often.
Yeah, John, I'm curious because you went to New York City and you grew up with Kentucky plants and Kentucky sensibilities. Was it hard to find the plants and you have to change your style to some extent to work on the New York rooftops?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really have a style. I mean, I was just gardening in the, you know, out there and home. And, you know, and I've had great professors at UK, and I learned my plants. But as far as any, I've never taken a design course, so I don't even, you know, I don't know.
Right.
It was kind of close because we're similar. We're in the same zone, 6 and 7 there in the city. And I think what was great is, like any, I think, good gardener, they watch and they see what's going on and they see what works. And I certainly had to learn because, I didn't learn anything about container gardens on rooftops in college. So,
how about plant availability, though? Did you have to go to New Jersey or Connecticut to find plants you wanted?
I did, and that's why I moved out. I bought a house 20 years. I've been in New York 21 years, and I bought a house 20 years ago in Bucks County, which is 62 miles outside of Manhattan.
Right, Pennsylvania.
And I like being out there because my growers are, you know, I have the people I work with. And
So kind of baby steps, right? You just kind of do what's right in front of you, and then you look back and you've amassed this body of work and knowledge. Do you know what I mean? You don't really know what's happening when it's happening.
And it's funny because, you know, when I read stuff, you know, and it says, oh, celebrity, you know, gardener, and I'm thinking, oh,
You're just you, right?
They don't even know I'm taking out garbage. You know, that's all I do. That's my life story. Picking up after my pup. You know?
There you go.
But it's just fun. You know, you just work.
Yeah.
That's all I do is work.
Well, part of the work that you do is as author. You had talked about some of the projects that you worked on in Louisville, Lexington, you know, the work that brought you home more often. Was that a little bit of what inspired you to write your new book, which is Beautiful Gardens of Kentucky, John, just to sort of share these places that you get to see with the rest of the public?
Well, it kind of happened by accident. About 6 years ago, the Martha Stewart people came out and did a story on my house in Bucks County. And I did all Kentucky food and, you know, and they saw all my big bourbon bar and loved it. And, you know, they stayed all week because, you know, they don't mess around. They do it the right way. And so I would just tell them, I said, hey, come to Kentucky because a lot of, you know, you never see Kentucky gardens in the magazines. It's always the Northeast, Bucks County, California. You know, you just never see beautiful gardens in national magazines really from the middle of the country. And so they said, well, why don't you scout a bunch for us? And so I did. I went through about 40 one summer, five, six years ago. And they picked one, and they photographed it for their magazine. And then I realized, like, no one would be able to see all these gardens that I've seen that are done by other people. You know, I see my own stuff. I'm tired of it.
Right.
You know, I like looking at other people's stuff.
Sure.
You know, it's and this book is about, it's about what Kentucky, people think of it as one thing, and Kentucky has got, it's diverse, and it's people, and it's gardens, and that's what I wanted to show in this book. Mm-hmm. 5 of the 21 are mine, but the rest of them are just gardens I've always admired.
Yeah. So, you know what I liked about it? Because, as you said, you know, other places are often featured in books and in magazines, and, you know, we've done interviews with authors that have researched, like, the DuPont gardens and homes, and, you know, there's so much fascinating history to it, but that's what it is. It's like kind of history preserved in a certain way, and when you look at the gardens and sort of the introductions that you provide for each one, it's a more, like, immediate contemporary sort of experience to these places.
It's
as opposed to, as opposed to this historical perspective on how they developed, but what's being done now and how they're being lived in and used.
And that's, you know, that's what fascinates me. And I will say, I'm, you know, all I deal with is problems. I mean, as a garden designer, you're not asking me to come to your house because you want to have tea. Who has time for that in the first place? But I come because people have a problem and they want me to fix it. So in this book, I didn't want it to all be, and it could have very easily been, you know, the huge, huge thing with 5 full-time gardeners, and it's all beautiful and shot in the month of June, you know.
Right.
But instead, if you know me, I'm a, you know, equal opportunity person, and I like things small, I like it big, I like it modern, I like it traditional, I like it all, or else I get bored, you know.
And knowing where you come from, you'll understand this question, but none of these people work at Toyota. You know, they're not blue-collar workers. Do you ever get the urge sometime to find a garden, somebody works at Toyota and goes home from 7 to 9 and has a great garden in their backyard to kind
of... Well, I think you'd be surprised. A couple of these people in here are, you know, just kind of pretty ordinary, actually.
Okay.
But they've just done extraordinary things. Well, the most clever of all the gardens in the whole book, to me, is Lois M. Poland's. And she's got this little cottage, sort of, you know, kind of craftsman cottage in Lexington.
And oh, yeah.
She just, oh, my gosh, what she's done with that. You know, using her next-door neighbor's buildings as backdrops. She,
yeah.
She went to the neighbors and said, I'll paint your... this side of you, I'll take care of this side of your building if I can paint whatever I want.
Is that the
zebras? That's making your own. Yeah. That's making your own world, and I love it when people do that.
Mm-hmm. She had like zebras or horses or something in there, giraffes maybe.
That's another. Now that I did that one, that's another one that. Okay, this was a client when I was right out of college. She hired me to do her traditional townhome, three stories, you know, townhome, and then she owned this building that was a restaurant. Very popular restaurant in Lexington for 12 years, and it went out of business. And she owned the building and decided she wanted to put her home in there. And so she renovated it, did all reclaimed wood from you know, that company Longwood Antiques that does the reclaimed floors. Everybody was trying to do this traditional, you know, they're trying to do the traditional thing with her style and this modern building. And so when she finally got a hold of me, you know, she went through the right channel. She called Mama me immediately. And then I called her back, and I said, I'd love to work with you again.
Yeah.
And, but, I mean, we used, for her fences, we used recycled. They were old handrails, and we put them in concrete, and that creates a barrier for the vines to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, in the old sign of the restaurant, we put on its side, and put a liner in it, and it's now a pond in the back.
Mm-hmm.
So just that's a great little garden. And
We were talking off the air before we got you on the air, and my sense was these pictures were real. They just were, because I've seen so many books that are two notches above real or way too pretty for their own good. But this, there's just a sense of real in these things. Even some of the leaves have occasionally have holes in them, like bugs actually live in and leaves, you know. So that was just really almost gratifying to see.
I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, anyone that knows me, I'm real.
Yeah.
Okay, they think, now if you don't know me, you think, oh, the celebrity gardener that drives the Range Rover in nice clothes that never, you know.
Right.
If only, you know, they don't, anyone who says that doesn't know me. Anybody that knows me, there's not a more real person on this earth than me and my family.
Yeah.
You know?
So another theme, John, that I guess I just subtly pick up, and you speak of how quite a few of these people are, you know, preservationist and conservationist, but there's an idea of like the landscape and the importance of just land, you know. So it's not necessarily just the garden, but it's the farmland part of these places that is part of this garden idea. Do you think Kentucky actually? Do you think we have a unique opportunity, maybe, to focus on how important just land is, that it doesn't have to be turned into some sort of estate garden, but that it can also just be farmland?
It can be natural, and that's the thing. Because what happens if, you know, we all want progress and we all want these things, but if you don't keep your state and you don't keep it the way parts of it that's natural, then once it's gone, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, just go to Lower Bucks County where I live, and it's the scariest place on earth. And up where I live, where people fight to keep all the farms and keep it, it's gorgeous. So, you know, you have to have a place for children to go out and enjoy and have parks and spaces, because if they don't, they're never gonna amount to much. You know, I mean, they're going to be so out of touch with reality.
Yeah.
And
this
is, and garden, I mean, nature is reality to me. I mean, I think, well, it should be.
So are listeners looking for day trips? Is there still the presence in Rockcastle County that can go see and visit gardens down there that you, where your parents lived or you lived? Or?
Our place is open 6 days a week. We're closed on Sunday, but we grew up in tourism, so we've always right. kind of had it open to people, and there's beautiful gardens, and then there's the old structure. My great-great-uncle built that in the 1890s, and Mom and Daddy bought it from being torn down and moved it about 45 miles away. So there's all these little old buildings they've saved from back in the 50s and 60s, and that's why I got along with the Bruckheimers. That's what they're doing now. You know, they're doing right. it with a big budget. We just did it, you know.
Yeah.
I got you.
I've been working with them. This is my, I guess, fifth year, and it's really come together there.
Yeah.
She has such a sense of, she was afraid to, at the first couple of years I worked with them, she was really afraid to let me do anything because she thought I was going to turn it into something that, you know, that was not what she, you know, she was afraid. So like when I would do beds of...
John?
Yes?
What, explain to our listeners the Bruckheimers' property, because
okay.
there's, you know, like the big house, but then also like these old historic log cabins and all of that.
Well, you know, Lyndon Jerry Bruckheimer, he's the most successful producer in the history of Hollywood.
Right.
And his wife was originally from Kentucky. So they wanted to move back, and listen, if anybody's been to California and, you know... Just go to one party, and that'll do you for. You'll want to come back racing back home to Kentucky, you know, and just get out in the dirt. So that's what she did, and she bought the beautiful. She owns her grandmother's home, which is a beautiful farmhouse, beautiful.
Okay.
But they bought like the big kind of historic home,
mm-hmm.
and then they started buying up all these buildings, like log cabins, and they would move them, and they've created
okay.
a little community for their guests when they come, you know, at Derby or whenever. And it's down to, you know, they built a cannery. They've built, you know, it's like going into early America. Down, I mean, she is on top of it.
And she wants to
by the woman, okay?
And she wants to maintain that historical integrity.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And when I came, she... was afraid that I was going to turn it into, a cul-de-sac. But what she didn't understand is who I am and where I come from. And she'd never seen where I grew up. And then once she came down there, then she had met, you know, my family and saw all of our old buildings and how natural everything looks. And she goes, oh, I get it. Okay. All right. Now do your thing. But just like, say, when we did... Black Eyed Susans on a hill. I placed them in a bed, but then I also put a few like where they fell down the hill where they just would naturally recede. So I'm kind of trying to create a little history. So it's all really natural looking. Mm-hmm. Nothing looks like it's been too tended to.
It's not gardeny.
Right.
You know, it's beautiful. Those log cabins are just awesome. You're going to also be designing for the World Equestrian.
Yes,
event. You're going to be designing the gardens, like the Kentucky Pavilion thing there, right?
Yes. I'm using all native plants
okay.
To Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
The containers are going to be sort of the larger ones going to be the iconic, you know, the cattle troughs that so I can hold a
Great.
Lot.
Great. Awesome.
And then we're using boxes out of reclaimed wood mm-hmm. from barns mm-hmm. that have been torn down. But using all Kentucky natives, and I'm doing it for free for the state.
Great.
As long as they donate it all to the park system and take it, you know,
yeah.
and let it go, you know.
Let it be.
You know, all that stuff sometimes at those shows, it all ends up in somebody's house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And our state parks are our treasure, and anyone could always use more plants.
Sure.
You know?
No, that's a great idea. Sounds good.
And then Altec, I'm doing theirs, designing their gardens, and... I've been working a year with him on that, and they're a pleasure to work with. Mm-hmm. I love them.
Good.
But theirs is going to sort of represent. They're in 130 countries, so I'm able to do more. You know, I'm doing kind of tropical area, Asian.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be fun.
Look forward to seeing all that. We appreciate your time, John.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. And the Rockcastle River Trading Company is open 6 days a week, so people can go.
Yep, 9 to 5. Closed in the winter.
Uh-huh.
And my website is a good thing to, because you can see where I'm going to be giving a talk or
okay
whatever. It's www.johncarloftis.com.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing you later this afternoon. John will be speaking Sunday, May 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Henry Clay Building, which is at 3rd and Chestnut in downtown Louisville. And the proceeds will benefit Brightside and Botanica. And guests are welcome at the door. John Karloftis, thanks again. John is a professional gardener, designer, and writer. His work can be seen on the Terrace Gardens of New York, at Ashland, on the rooftop of 21C, and at his home in Rockcastle County, Kentucky. And as I said, you can meet him and see more about the beautiful gardens of Kentucky today at the Henry Clay.
Coming up next, we head to the Louisville Zoo to celebrate World Turtle Day. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Miss Wishy, we just survived feeding a 500-pound turtle.
We did.
Celery sticks.
It was pretty cool.
That was fun.
It was awesome.
Crunch, crunch,
and there will
crunch.
Be pictures, so if you want to see it.
Right.
And they didn't bite your finger off.
And we're here in honor of World Turtle Day, and we've come to the best place we could possibly be. We're with Bill McMahon, who's been curator of ectotherms at the Louisville Zoo for 29 years and knows a whole lot about these things. So, Bill, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thanks, Bob. Janine, it's good to see you.
Yeah.
Let's begin with the big question. What is an ectotherm, and what's a nice guy like you doing messing around with them all these years?
Well, ectotherms are some of the most fascinating animals on Earth. They include all kinds of insects and reptiles, fish, frogs, all kinds of things like that. So most of the animal life on Earth is ectothermic, and that just means these are animals that derive their body temperature from external sources, the sun, a warm rock, that kind of thing, rather than generating it internally like you and I do.
Ecto.
From ecto.
From the around you.
Ecto, I got you. I knew she was going to get it out. The school mom and her was just waiting to jump
the
out.
Latin part,
that's
yeah.
That's right. Go ahead, Miss Wishy.
So, okay, I have loads of personal questions, so I'll try to be organized because I love observing nature, and I don't always know what turtle is what. So if we can first kind of address our native species in Kentucky, what would one find likely if they were out and about by a body of water or on land, you know, and if there's differences in the turtle world?
There are differences in kinds of turtles here in Kentucky. Kentucky is blessed with 13 different species of turtles found in 3 different families. These include snapping turtles, musk turtles, mud turtles, map turtles, painted turtles, the turtle that we grew up as children knowing as a terrapin. Those are box turtles. That's about the only land turtle that you'll find here in the bluegrass, but most of the others are tied closer to water to varying degrees.
Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I always assume who I'm seeing because of our farm pond lake, and they're really large, are the snapping turtles. So is there a way for a person to generally assess the differences between the different species? Am I assuming too much that everybody's a snapper?
There are differences in patterns, markings, the way their shells are constructed, things like that. Snappers are known for having short tempers and long tails.
Okay.
Any turtle that you see that has a tail about as long as its shell is certainly a snapping turtle, and they are common here in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. You can find them in virtually any body of water, from drainage ditches to Kentucky Lake and the Ohio River. They're also the turtle that figures most prominently in food here in Kentucky, because when people eat turtle, it's invariably a snapping turtle. And part of the reason is because they get large, up to 50, even 60 pounds in some instances.
So the average box turtle that I might encounter would generally appear how?
You'd usually encounter a box turtle either in someone's yard that's adjacent to a field or a creek or a patch of woodland. Box turtles that are called terrapins here in Kentucky by a lot of older folks. You don't hear that term as much anymore these days. But box turtles are found in forested areas. They like humid sections of forest. They eat all kinds of berries. mushrooms, fungi, snails, slugs, that kind of thing. And they live a long time, maybe up to a century or more.
And what's their size typically, Bill?
They're usually about 5 to 6 inches long as adults. Babies are really hard to find. When they hatch, they're just a little over an inch long.
Bill, how long have turtles been around on planet Earth, and are they found in all the continents?
They're not found in Antarctica. They're found in Europe and Africa and South America, North America, just about everywhere else, Australia included. They have been around a long time. We estimate in excess of 200 million years. The box turtle that we were discussing just a moment ago, they're good fossil records from Nebraska that go back to the late Miocene. That's about 10 or 12 million years ago.
Do we know why you have all these special features as a turtle?
Well, turtles really, when you think about it, there are about 250 species worldwide, and they're pretty conservative when you get right down to it. I mean, all turtles are encased with a shell. They're modified ribs that are extremely specialized that they use to protect their bodies. And just about all turtles, whether they're land tortoises or sea turtles or what we're more familiar with, and like red-eared sliders, painted turtles, things like that, virtually all of them are omnivorous. There's some that specialize and are more herbivorous, like most dry land tortoises. There's some like snappers and soft-shelled turtles that appear more carnivorous. But push comes to shove, they're amazingly adaptable, and all will eat plant and animal matter if the situation calls for it.
Yeah, we just saw the 500-pound turtles in there, and we fed them the celery. Talk some about those and how big they can get and what their life cycle is like.
Well, those were Aldabra tortoises. Those are a species that hails from the island of Aldabra, which is in the Indian Ocean, not too far from Madagascar. At one time, many of the islands in the Indian Ocean were homes to these giant land tortoises, but during the 16 and 1700s, when a lot of these ships were moving from Portugal and Spain and England to China and the Far East for the spice trade, they would go around the southern Africa there, and a lot of those sailors would be really hungry for fresh meat. So they would stop off on these islands and eat these giant land tortoises, which, as you mentioned, they're 400 or 500 pounds. They're great food. And many of these were stored upside down in the cargo holds of these ships because they afforded the sailors with fresh meat.
Wow.
These giant land tortoises, like Aldabras and Galapagos tortoises, these things live a long time. There's a well-documented instance of an animal that was held on St. Helena Island in the South Atlantic, where Napoleon was exiled. And this tortoise had been brought there as an adult, and a soldier cleaning his rifle, it discharged accidentally and hit the turtle in the head and killed it. But that turtle had been on the island 152 years. So these things truly do live a long time. A lot of people think that's an old wives' tale, but it's one that's supported by evidence. They do live a long time.
And much of that can be perhaps attributed to, as you mentioned before, they're pretty conservative.
They are conservative, and they're slow. You know, everybody jokes about the tortoise and the hare, but turtles, they have been around a long time, and they do eat a lot of different things, and they've exploited a lot of different environments given the limitations associated with being bound up in that shell. They're not the speediest of animals, things like that, but they inhabit torrid jungles and deserts and even the ocean and temperate zones like here. So when you think about all they've been able to colonize and flourish in, given the limitations of that shell, it's pretty remarkable.
Well, can we explore the shell a little bit more? Because clearly that's one of its number one advantages in terms of protection, but, you know, slows them down a bit perhaps otherwise.
Right.
What is the shell made up of, and can it regenerate if it's damaged? And, you know, how susceptible is the turtle to danger if there's some sort of breakdown?
It's living tissue. It's akin to bone. And people a century or two ago, I don't think they realized that. I think they thought it was just a dead material because people used to carve their initials and dates and things like that on box turtle shells. But because it's a living material, those tortoises or turtles, they can heal. And even animals that are hit by lawnmowers and things like that, they're really tough animals. And by and large, unless the wound is too serious, they generally heal.
Hmm.
Bill, all of us as kids find turtles in the backyard, bring them home, put them in a terrarium. How dangerous is that to the breed, and is that really a good practice or not?
I would say that unless you're able to look long-term and keep that turtle for a long period of time, that's legal to do in Kentucky. You don't have to have a hunting or fishing license in order to do that. But the problem that we hear about here at the zoo a lot are we're inundated by phone calls from people that picked up a turtle for their child when the child was young, and now the child's gone away to college or something like that.
Turtle's
and they call
still
us.
Alive.
Yeah, exactly. The turtle's still alive, and they want to donate to the zoo. And of course, we don't have the space necessary to accommodate all of these things. So I would just caution people that are interested in keeping a turtle for a pet that they do live 30, 40, 50, 60 years and longer. And they should be aware of that before they take on that responsibility. But that's not to dissuade a child that finds one in the garden and wants to keep it set up during the, you know, summer or something like that, maybe feed it. If they can release it back on its home range, that's great, because that turtle will know where to go to hibernate and survive the winter.
And speaking of finding them on the roads, you mentioned that earlier we were talking that they're more vulnerable maybe in June because the females are looking for a place to lay their eggs, are more likely to get run over or be on the road?
That's absolutely true, especially with snapping turtles. You see a lot of these things on the road in June, and they're invariably crossing a road trying to get someplace else where they can lay their eggs. Female snapping turtles and other species are trying to find areas that are above a floodplain so that the eggs won't be submerged underwater. The eggs can tolerate a little bit of submergence, maybe 24 hours, something like that. But if you get a true flood event and the water backs up and stays over the top of those nests for a while, it'll kill the eggs. So the turtles try to seek areas where they can lay eggs that are well above the floodplain so that when they hatch, even aquatic turtles, they'll make their way back down to the water.
How long until the eggs hatch typically?
Well, that's a great question. Generally, it's anywhere from about 2 months to 4 months. And interestingly, even inside the same nest, you can have wide variability like that. And the gender of turtle offspring is determined by the temperatures that they experience inside the nest.
Wow.
But some snapping turtles have been observed to lay eggs. And those things actually, the embryos will overwinter in the egg and hatch the following year. So in that event, the eggs might be something on the order of 9 months in terms of incubation. But obviously, when the ground cools during the winter, they do very little growing. They just sort of, they're alive in there, but they don't really, you know, grow in terms of mass or anything like that. But with warmer temperatures, they do and hatch that way.
Temperature related then,
yes.
Yeah. I had been operating under some, I think, misinformation, Bill, because I was under the impression that the slider turtle that is very common was a sort of pet shop turtle that went amok out in nature and was not a native species, but in fact it is, but they just proved to be extremely adaptable.
I think they are. I think sliders, they, as you mentioned, they are very popular in the pet trade and were years ago. That's invariably the species that people used to go to carnivals or circuses. They could find with a, you know, a picture or a mural painted on their little backs, things like that, which is very bad for them, by the way. It's important to try to get that off of them, like with nail polish remover or something like that. They don't do that so much anymore these days, but those turtles were very popular in the pet trade, and as a result, they were dispersed all over the world, literally. And there are populations of red-eared sliders that are indigenous, native to Kentucky, that you can find in far-flung parts of the world, in Asia and other places, that seem to flourish and do well. And you know, introduced species, I mean, we think of those things coming from foreign countries into the United States and causing a lot of problem or wreaking ecological havoc. I don't think it's to that scale where they've caused that kind of damage, but certainly where they flourish, they're keeping another native turtle species there from doing well because they eat a lot of the same things and take those resources and use them for an animal that's not native.
But they are native to Kentucky.
They are native to Kentucky, red-eared sliders. And in fact, down around Real Foot Lake in extreme southwestern Kentucky, there's a turtle industry that went on for about a century down there where they would sell turtles that came from Real Foot Lake.
This is a broad question, I know, but how endangered is the turtle in the world and around here, say, compared to some other species you work with and deal with?
Well, it depends. Certainly, there are turtles around the world that are under great duress. I would say that Southeast Asia, as a result of China's use of turtles, they use a lot of turtles in China that they've used up a lot of China's own native turtles, and so a lot of Southeast Asia exports turtles to China. And amazingly, there are even turtles collected here in the United States that are sent to China where they use it in traditional medicines and things like that. You can find them in open-air markets. But this is a real problem just because of the sheer volume of people that are there now that utilize these things. I mean, it's just they're draining quite a number of turtle species from Southeast Asia that way.
Are there turtle ranches or turtle farms that people are, you know, breeding these things and selling them to soups and for restaurants around the world, things like that?
There aren't many places that actually raise turtles for food. And part of the reason for that is because they take so long to reach sexual maturity. It's not like doing poultry or even cattle, for that matter. We're not looking at months. We're looking at years and years in terms to raise one from, you know, hatchling to adult market size. So as a result of that, most of the turtles that are used for cuisine and the food trade, they're invariably wild, trapped, or caught animals.
Okay, one more question. In terms of predators, what's their, you know, major threat? Us or other things?
The major predators of turtles, depending on what species, if we're going to talk about box turtles or what people used to call terrapins, they're automobiles and lawnmowers. We were discussing earlier, you know, you can have a turtle that's 20, 30, 40 years old that's in an area of forest and maybe, you know, grown-up farmland, things like that, and then they put in a shopping mall and a subdivision and four lanes of busy traffic over the life of that turtle, and every time that turtle tries to cross the road to use a part of its range, it's sort of playing Russian roulette to get through there. But natural predators here would be things like raccoons and skunks, coyotes, and raccoons are pretty proficient at eating turtles to the point that, as disgusting as it sounds, they don't necessarily kill them. They'll just gnaw off their legs sometimes, and you can find turtles that, you know, only have one leg or two legs in nature where a raccoon has picked it up and bitten off maybe the other limbs. And it's amazing that you find these things alive, but turtles, they're pretty tough.
They're conservative.
They are.
Very fascinating. Thank you so much.
Bill, as always, excellent. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Bill McMahon is the curator of ectotherms at the Louisville Zoo. For more information on the zoo, or Bill, or turtles, or to see pictures of Bob and Janine feeding a 500-pound turtle celery, visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we've raced back here from our turtle interview.
It took us a really long time, but we made it back.
Yeah, real slow. But we've got a couple questions to answer quickly, apparently.
Okay.
First one's for you.
All right.
I have ants on my raspberry plants. That sounds like a song. I have ants on my raspberry plants. This is the first year with them. They are very young, the plants, of course, with a few immature berries. What can I do to get rid of them?
I assume that he wants to get rid of the ants.
Yeah, not the berries.
Honestly, don't get rid of them. Ants are just ants.
Yeah.
And they're not an indication of anything bad. They actually serve a really valuable purpose in the garden. They can aerate the soil. They can prey on, you know, certain pests. They do a whole slew of things.
And they don't eat raspberries either.
And they don't eat raspberries.
So you're safe.
Unless your raspberries already start rotting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then they may. I guess it's just rethinking what you need to get rid of. And ants, I don't think, are anything anybody needs to get rid of out in the garden.
If you came to picking them later on, you get ants all over. It might be a little different matter. You get ants on your fingers and stuff. But
ants on your fingers. Well, I mean, this is true. Yes. Yeah. But you still don't need to get rid of them. You just need to be reasonable.
Okay. Since you're the Burry Queen, I'm going to jump to the next question.
Okay.
You did that so well.
All right.
This is from Veronica.
Okay.
I was wondering if it would be a good idea to plant white clover around my blueberries. I've mulched them now and understand the importance of not disturbing their shallow root systems. Clover would do two things for me: eliminate the need to apply mulch every year, and give our honeybees a little extra food. Do you think it's a good idea?
I think it's a fabulous idea.
Okay.
And, in thinking about it, I can't really think of anything that would be prohibitive.
Their roots wouldn't interfere with the blueberry roots, you don't think?
I don't... You know, you might have to water more
if
we get into a drought situation because of competition. I would think that the clover might, provide some nitrogen-fixing ability.
That's true.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So might help fertilize. And definitely the bees will enjoy it. The only thing that I would say, Veronica, be careful when you're harvesting, because as much as I love bees and I'm so not afraid of being stung by them because I rarely ever am, occasionally if you step on them, they will sting you. So, just be careful in that regard. There may be something that is prohibitive that I'm just not seeing sort of straight out. I would think it would
Good
make
idea.
A lot of sense.
Well, let's hear back from Veronica. Maybe in 3 or 4 months she can email us again.
Yeah.
We'll do a follow-up
on if detrimental
on white clover
in
and the blueberries.
Yeah, I
nice
think it's a
color
great idea.
Combination, nothing else.
I think it's a great idea.
Okay.
All right.
If you have a question for Janine or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org or call us at 814-8246.
Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have?
It's all your fault again.
Okay.
We talked about turtles.
Uh-huh.
What's the plant?
Oh,
Turtlehead.
Turtlehead.
Chelone.
Chelone?
I looked it up.
Or Cologne?
No, it's Chelone.
Okay.
I looked it up. Believe me, I checked this 19 times. Chelone. It's more fun than I ever imagined as I get into these things. I just love it. If you don't have the Chelone in your garden or turtlehead, it's a North American native. It kind of likes soggy, shady areas. Mm-hmm. It grows maybe 2 to 3 feet tall, has a dark green leaf and kind of a deep white or pink flower. My favorite cultivar is Hot Lips.
Mm-hmm.
Named for Hot Lips of Houlihan, surely the unmashed Hot Lips Houlihan. And if you look at it real closely, the
looks
head
like
looks
head.
Like a turtle head.
Uh-huh.
It's got a great history. I got into this thing a little bit, how the Chelone got its name. Back when all the gods, men, and animals were invited by Hermes to attend the wedding of Zeus and Hera, Chelone stayed home, and she just didn't want to go.
Sort of like John in those L.A. parties, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Hermes descended from Olympus, threw her house, which stood on the bank of the river, into the river, and changed her into a tortoise, who henceforth had to carry her house on her back.
Huh.
That's where Chelone got its name.
Wow.
From the Greek goddess who didn't go to
Zeus's the party.
Wedding. Don't do that again. It's also one of about 50,000 native plants used as a diuretic. They must have used every tree and bush in America. But more important, it shows the amazing symbiotic relationship between plant and insect world. The Chelone is the official and most used host plant of the Baltimore checker spot butterfly.
Oh, really?
That's it.
Huh.
That's the one that the plant...
We always hear about... The monarch and milkweed,
The Chelone and the Baltimore checker spot butterfly.
I'll have to check that
They have
out.
To mate, they do.
Uh-huh.
So it's the official state insect of Maryland now, of course. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it comes with a poem. When mysteries of the plant world are impossible to see, we just shrug our shoulders. It's all Greek to me. But yet there are cases where that saying is true. So listen quite closely. This message is for you. The wood nymph Chelone, way back in the day, was invited to a wedding, a Grecian bouquet, uniting Zeus and Hera in everlasting bliss, not the type of wedding that anyone should miss. But Chelone stayed home, perhaps she was ill, but Zeus took it personally, as only gods will. And he sent forth his messenger, a guy named Hermes, whose mission in life was always to please. He tracked down Chelone, the message to deliver, tossing her in her house right into the river, where she became the tortoise, for all there to see, and now you understand why it's all Greek to me.
There we go. Excellent. Chelone. I'm going to have to keep an eye out on my Chelone to see what kind of butterflies visit her this year.
Yeah, the Baltimore checker spot is
on
its way.
That'll be one identification, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Bob. That ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, the American Life Building has a real green roof and a great view of the city. We'll be on top of it all next week.
Homegrown is produced by the fast-moving Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.